Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, Americans, many of them anyway, have been filled with outrage and anger and sadness at the fact that immigrants escaping violence and deprivation, some of it visited on them by U.S. policy and practice, are being treated as criminals at the U.S. border. Children being literally pulled from their parents' arms and locked up in pens. And it's all in aid of what exactly? The truth is, U.S. policy on immigration has long veiled, thinly, in abject cruelty and racism. And so while outrage at family separation at the Mexican border is a fine starting point for a movement for change, it cannot be its end. We'll talk about bigger, positive visions on immigration with Jacinta Gonzalez, senior campaign organizer at Mi Gente, the national political hub for Latinx organizing. Also on the show, corporate U.S. media coverage of Haiti, as with many places, is inconsistent and shallow. But the shallow coverage of Haiti is especially ahistorical and disempowering. Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. You hear that a lot. ABC's George Stephanopoulos once described the country's problems as biblical. But they are, in fact, political, social, economic problems that have identifiable roots, and the international community has a big role in them. So now, when you hear that protests over a hike in fuel prices in Haiti are causing chaos, you should know there's much more to it. We'll talk about that with Jocelyn McCalla, longtime director of the National Coalition for Haitian Rights, now advocacy coordinator for Haitian Americans United for Progress. That's coming up. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. Images of weeping toddlers torn from their stunned mother's arms, of children in cages, or what some insist you call chain-link fenced holding areas, and of three-year-olds representing themselves in deportation or asylum proceedings, these have outraged and galvanized many Americans in protest of the Trump administration's racist, cruel, anti-immigration, and anti-immigrant policies. Outrage is justified, but if we intend to translate it to substantive change, we're going to need to build out from this immediate, visible crisis to connect it to all of the other factors and actors that make today's headlines possible. So what now for those who recognize family separation of immigrants to the U.S. as no outlier, but part of a broader social agenda that goes well beyond the U.S.-Mexico border? Our next guest has been organizing against immigration enforcement and the criminalization of Latinx and immigrant communities for years. Jacinta Gonzalez is senior campaign organizer at Mi Gente, the national political hub for Latinx organizing. She joins us now by phone from Phoenix. Welcome to Counterspin, Jacinta Gonzalez.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, families belong together has broad appeal as an idea. Broad surface appeal, if I may say. Even media who are trying hard have had trouble finding people to give a full-throated endorsement of the idea of pulling children from their parents who are trying to enter the country. That is beyond, well, they brought this on themselves, you know. But the power of positive messaging aside, is it your sense that families belong together is just not a sufficient organizing principle for bringing about the real change that we want to see? How do we need to grow that idea?
I think what we saw clearly with this newly created crisis by this administration is that when we simply demand things like family unity, what we get is family unity behind bars. And so for us, it was really necessary to be able to raise awareness of not only what was happening with the devastation of young children being separated from their parents, but also with the criminalization of migration and mass prosecutions of folks who are entering this country. Because with this analysis, we're able to actually make demands that would get to the root of the problem instead of just treating the most horrific, but yet the manifestation of the actual policy.
Right. Well, in your very straightforward piece, How to Stop Child Separation, Stop Sending Their Parents to Prison, that you wrote last month for Truthout, you talked about, you know, if we really want to go forward from this and we want to use our very warranted feelings of upset and anger at what we're seeing to really end the crisis, there are a number of elements of that work that we could be looking at. What are some of the things that you're pointing to that folks might direct energy to?
We put out a policy platform that kind of describes that there's both movement demands that we're making, but there's also really concrete things that both Congress can do, different government agencies can do to try to get us a little bit closer to the real solution to some of these problems. For us, a primary demand or a central tenet is the abolishment of ICE as an agency. We know that family separation has been happening not only at the border, but also when deportations are taking place and parents are being separated from their families, but also community members more broadly are being separated from their loved ones and from people that they share their lives with. And so we think that ICE as an agency should be completely abolished, which means there should be a moratorium on deportations. There should be a defunding of the agency. We should end all forms of detention. And those are very concrete demands that can be accomplished now. But we also point to the need to decriminalize migration. You know, the laws that are on the books that are allowing Jeff Sessions to throw the book at people are laws that were written in the 1930s by a legislator that was openly advocating for lynching, that was against interracial marriage, and that promoted the criminalization of migration. And so it's time for us to take a strong stand and decriminalize that as well by taking away Section 1325 and 1326 that allows for these prosecutions to happen.
I think we did start to see maybe an advance over the conversation that we had around DACA and the Dreamers, which was very much about, let's not punish these innocent children for the crimes of their parents. And it was this very invidious and kind of confused understanding of what crime is and of what it means to try to isolate. I mean, to me, it reminded me, frankly, of the welfare reform conversation around 1996, where we had media talking about, yes, let's punish these lazy mothers, but how do we protect their children? You know, it's a very kind of artificial conversation. But I feel as though things have maybe moved on a little bit from that to where we can see a distinction between crime and criminalization, you know, making things a crime. I don't know. Am I too optimistic there? Or do you think people are starting to understand what it really means to criminalize immigration itself?
I think we see tendencies going both ways. Mm-hmm. So I actually think there's a lot of things that are really exciting about seeing people broaden their analysis of criminalization and their understanding of policing, understanding that Immigration and Customs Enforcement and Border Patrol are policing agencies. And so that a lot of the same critiques that can be applied to ICE also apply to the police. And so it kind of broadens the conversation and the possibilities of what we can do and what kinds of alliances we can build, particularly between Black and Latinx communities. But you also have, I think there's a tendency in the center to try to say that this is not the time for radical demands that actually give different possibilities, that we should say things like, well, we'll give you the wall, but legalize this many people.
Right.
And I think we've seen a couple of rounds of that. You know, we had legislators saying that they would negotiate with Trump on some of these policies, knowing full well the far, far right-wing agenda that he's pushing. So I think we also have to see the opportunity of being able to have more people understand the criminalization. And I think we also have to be wary of not taking advantage of this moment, because it's unveiling what the system truly is meant to do. And so these are the moments where we can actually provide other options and alternatives to folks beyond what many mainstream Democrats have been presenting as solutions.
Absolutely. Well, I want to talk about that vision. The International Red Cross just released a report talking about the new walled order, as they put it, and saying that criminalizing aid and public services for immigrants and migrants is setting back advances by a century. And what they're calling for is just a simple separation from immigration policy and from those policies regarding access to food and health care and legal advice. You know, so they're also applying it to the French mayor who said that distributing food at a migrant camp was illegal, and the Italian government that's saying NGOs can't go out into Libyan waters with search and rescue missions and all of that. I feel that that international vision is necessary to, you know, broadening the context of what's happening at just the U.S.-Mexico border, which you've just indicated is really not only about the U.S.-Mexico border. But I think an international vision and a bigger picture of migration worldwide would help here.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we have to have a broader vision of migration because, you know, migration has been happening for centuries. And given the increases in wealth disparities and the added crisis of climate change, we're going to be seeing more and more of it. And unfortunately, for a lot of countries, the response has been a militarized criminalization of migration that is creating a worse human rights crisis, but also creating economic incentives for people to try to continue to promote an agenda of dealing with it that increases countries' ability to incarcerate, to surveil, to police. And so I do think we have to understand this within the broader context and also understand it, again, within the framework of if we continue to have a system that responds to everything with punishment and criminalization, we're going to continue to confront this better over and over again, and not just in migration. You know, we're seeing it with reproductive justice issues. We're seeing it with climate justice. We're seeing it with the legal justice system that this country also uses. And so I think we have to have a broader analysis that connects all of those dots.
Well, let me just bring you back finally, if I could, to the idea of abolishing ICE, which I think is fascinating. I've heard it said, you know, it's one of those things that is presented as, well, you can't get rid of a government agency, even if it's an agency that only recently came into existence. And part of what I hate, frankly, about corporate media is the way that they try to limit our political possibilities, you know? So abolishing ICE is the kind of idea that the corporate media will tell us is laughable and impossible until we do it, and then they'll act like they invented it. And I just wonder, how do you encourage people to think around the ideas and the limitations that they're getting from news media, for example, and do the work outside of that and get beyond of that? I feel like, you know, work that occurs outside the media lens in some ways is free from some of the limitations that media try to present to people about what is possible and what can happen.
Yeah, I mean, you know, your idea is being taken seriously when a former Department of Homeland Security chief is saying that it shouldn't be promoted as a policy demand.
Right.
You know, there is those processes where, well, we're in an actual conversation about it, which means that it is possible
right.
and could be done. And so I think it's important to grapple with that or to, you know, to use that energy in the moment that is there. ICE as an agency was only created with the purpose of detaining and deporting people. It was, in fact, designed as an agency to terrorize immigrant communities. And so I think that it is very possible and realistic to get rid of it. There are a million other agencies that help in different parts of immigration laws in this country, and you don't need ICE to be able to do the other functions. So I think it's very possible to completely get rid of it, have a moratorium on deportations, defund ICE as an agency, restructure resources, and there doesn't have to be a replacement. I think we have to be very concerned with people who are advocating that it be readjusted and housed within the Department of Justice. I think we're seeing the worries of what can happen with the Department of Justice, who that is only aimed at incarcerating people. Housing our immigration policies there would only make that worse. So I actually think we have to be able to reimagine different structures. And I think what we're seeing is that also the American public has an appetite for it. We saw it with the most recent victory of different congressional representatives that are running in New York, but I think we've seen it with over 100 candidates coming out publicly to support the demand. So I think we're also seeing that we're able to do it as a policy, and it's a platform that people will vote for.
Well, let me just ask you finally if you have any thoughts in terms of media coverage that you'd like to disappear right now, but also some that you would like to encourage, that you would like to encourage reporters to do more of on this issue as we go forward.
I do think that it's important to continue to do reporting on what is happening with the Department of Justice and migration. We saw the first impacts of criminalizing people who are crossing the border, but we're going to see a higher and higher uptick in people being prosecuted for other types of things, like working without documents or coming back to be with your children here. We're seeing that more and more the Department of Justice and Jeff Sessions are promoting an agenda to lock as many people up as possible. Migration is one component of that. The war on drugs is another component of that. The war on dissent is another component of that. These are all agendas that folks are moving from Washington, D.C., that have long roots in white supremacy, and they need to be fought back against, and they need to be documented, because we can't realize what's happening until it's too late and communities are serving year-long sentences as a result.
We've been speaking with Jacinta Gonzalez of Mi Gente. They're online at migente.net. Her article, How to Stop Child Separation, Stop Sending Their Parents to Prison, can still be found at truthout.org. Jacinta Gonzalez, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mount Juliet Mission Group stalled in Haiti. Missionary from Hubbardston weathers protests in Haiti. Riots delay Lowell missionaries' return from Haiti. Raleigh Church Group returning from Haiti after civil unrest. Judging by headlines, one might assess that the significant thing about public protests in Haiti, particularly Port-au-Prince, is that they have interrupted the travel of U.S. missionary groups. Reading further, you may learn that the immediate spark for the unrest was a proposed hike in fuel prices, a 38% increase in the price of gas, 47% for diesel, and 51% for the kerosene many people use to heat and cook. But in general, the Miami Herald's Jacqueline Charles was a notable exception, big U.S. media outlets just don't seem all that interested in what's happening in Haiti, and so stories focused on Americans who tried to help but got caught up in violence take center stage, reinforcing a media storyline that has tended to present Haiti as a place of almost inherent chaos and a bottomless pit for international aid. It's a sad, static vision that doesn't encourage much thinking about positive ways forward for Haiti and Haitians. Joining us now to help shed a different light on things is Jocelyn McCalla, the longtime director of the National Coalition for Haitian Rights. He's now advocacy coordinator for the group Haitian Americans United for Progress. He joins us now by phone from Brooklyn. Welcome to Counterspin, Jocelyn McCalla.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I understand that there had been news of this fuel price increase before July 5th. It was not a total surprise. And the fuel hike, which the government subsequently rescinded, is really only one of a number of things feeding frustration among many Haitians and between many Haitians and the leadership of President Jovenel Moïse. What more is there to this situation that maybe we're not getting from news reports?
Well, that is absolutely correct. Frustration with Haitian government policy has been building up for quite a long time. So the announcement that fuel prices were going to be hiked to what many Haitians believe are an acceptable level essentially tipped things over, and Haitians express their frustrations visibly with street demonstrations and taking their ire against several businesses that had set up shop, not in the capital city of Port-au-Prince, which is what a lot of media is reporting, but in its outlying suburb of Pétionville, which in fact has become the economic center of Haiti since the 2010 earthquake. So let me very quickly run through some of the issues that Haitians have faced over the last several months. The government has lavishly spent on itself and very little on basic necessities and basic social welfare, schools, education, hospitals. A lot of the people working in the public sector have not been paid in several months. They basically live from hand to mouth and essentially, you know, have to borrow money or live on credit. And the fact is that their debt and their obligations are increasing while the government has done nothing, you know, to alleviate their distress. That's one issue. The second issue is that for months, you know, people have been saying, given the rate of inflation in Haiti, which has been quite high, cost of living has gone up, and there has been demand for wage hike, which has been completely ignored. So in fact, when people compare the price hike for the gas and what the wages would deliver, it's essentially on the same par. So most Haitians live on about $3 a day. I mean, if they're employed, I mean, they get about $3 a day. And the gasoline price hike would rise to about $5 a gallon, which meant that for a worker who has a steady job, it would become nearly impossible to save any money or bring back any money to home where they could feed their family. Those are the kind of things that rarely get in the news, as you mentioned earlier. The third thing I would mention is that when I said, for example, that the Haitian government has lavished in the privileges upon itself, they've also, they and their own associates have engaged in several land grabs using the power of government, using their authority, using brute force to essentially kick people out of the property. In fact, a week before the price hike, or perhaps even less than that, the president ordered several dwellings near his home to be destroyed. People were just given a few hours to essentially leave everything behind, leave the property that they had behind, and very quickly bulldozers came in and destroyed their homes. And all for, and allegedly, the fact that the president wanted to build a heliport so that he could avoid the huge traffic jams that are now a daily occurrence in Port-au-Prince and in Pétionville. So those are the kind of things that Haitians have been frustrated with. So when the government basically said, hey, listen, we're going to raise the price of gas, everything is going to be costing much more, and the fact is that it's going to lead to the IMF and the World Bank and other international financial institutions provide us with money so that we can cover our costs and budgetary costs, I mean, normal routine budgetary costs. People basically said, you know, this is not going to happen. This is silly. This is unacceptable, and we're not going to have any of it.
Well, I read a quote from a former prime minister saying that because Moïse didn't have a strong, structured opposition in front of him, he thought he had the political capital to impose an unpopular measure. So what can be said about other forces? Is there a sort of counterforce to the machinations of Moïse within the Haitian government? Who can people look to?
Well, I think a lot of the structured political parties have become weaker, in fact, as it has been reported. But I think that the part of what Mr. Moïse and his acolytes in government seriously underestimating is the frustration of people who are essentially tired of being taken for granted, tired of bearing the cost of poverty and being mired in poverty for how many years, and whose only exit out of it, and it might be, if it comes to pass, you know, leaving, you know, for better refuge abroad. A lot of Haitians have migrated to Chile, to Brazil, to the Dominican Republic. They're making their way out of Haiti, which is unfortunate because what happens here is that Haiti is losing, you know, some of its best able-bodied people to migration.
Well, let me ask you finally about the diaspora. When Donald Trump made his vulgar and insulting comments about Haiti, along with other countries where black and brown people live this January, and apparently specifically asked, why do we want people from Haiti here? Your response at the time was to say, Haitians in the United States should keep your eyes on the prize and don't get distracted. What are some of the things that you mean by that? And has Donald Trump changed the experience or the feeling in the Haitian community here?
Well, obviously, Donald Trump's putting down Haitians in the most vulgar terms has essentially made Haitians realize that if they're going to fight for their rights in this country, that they're going to have to stand up and they're going to have to organize themselves in such a way as to pick up the struggles that, in fact, led to the growth of the Haitian community from the 1970s on. To a certain extent, the policies being carried out by the Trump administration today are no different from policies that Haitians experienced themselves in the 70s and the 80s. There was a Haitian program. The kind of attitude, very negative attitude against Haitians prevail was in the 70s as well, because basically you had people in what was then the INS. Like saying that we don't want these Haitians here, we don't want them, we don't want these black people, which in fact led to a lot of the civil rights groups in this country to take up the Haitian struggle and their struggle for asylum and refugee rights. But this said, the fact is that when we said that people have to keep their eyes on the prize, that meant, one, organize yourself. Two, Mr. Trump is not the last person, you know, who's got a say on this. I mean, there are other institutions in the United States and that have say in what will be eventually the immigration policy of the United States. I mean, obviously, the president has a lot of power, as the Supreme Court has indicated, in defining what immigration policy is. But the fact is that what we have here is a situation in which, as people organize themselves, as people structure themselves to fight back, we've seen the government push back on policies as well. So that's why we say, keep your eyes on the prize and organize, organize, and organize.
We've been speaking with Jocelyn McCalla of the group Haitian Americans United for Progress. They're online at haupinc.org. Jocelyn McCalla, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
It's been my pleasure.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and their transcripts on FAIR's website. That's FAIR.org. And the website's also the place to sign up for FAIR's Action Alert Network. The show's engineered by Erica Rosato. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.